Welcome to the Grow Their Wealth Financial Advisor Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Ganesh. On episode 15, I speak with Chris George and Mark Schutten of Broadreach Strategic Planning. They share the story of how they came into the financial planning business as a second career and quickly learned that having a retail practice wasn't going to be for them. We discuss how they narrowed in on millennial dentists as their key niche, how they did that even when they didn't have a single dentist on their books, and how despite sheer persistence and consistency, it took them at least 4 years to really establish themselves amongst dentists to the point where clients now regularly find them. You'll want to listen closely for all the marketing nuggets they share, as well as learn what it takes to become a technical specialist working with a niche market such as dentists. This episode is brought to you by Valenta BPO, a provider of virtual assistants who are trained specifically in doing technical financial planning, insurance, and investment work. Hey, Mark, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sam. Good afternoon.
Great to have you guys. Super excited. Maybe let's just kick off with Chris. Tell us kind of how you got into the financial advisory space.
Actually, it's interesting. I was at UBC, graduated in one thing, started off in a different career than what I graduated in, and was just...
What was that?
I skip those ones. It's honestly embarrassing to say, so I'm just going to skip ahead. But the point is I actually was working...
No, but now I want to hear it.
I was working in computers for 16 years until 2008. I have a twin brother who got me to switch over from computers, which he knew I was just not that excited about anymore. 16 years, you have to understand that when I first started the computers, almost the internet was brand new. Like it was back in the early 90s and home computers were... It was the Wild West for computers. But over 16 years, as you get the huge stores coming in, et cetera, and products, just the same thing day in, day out, he got me to switch over to finance because he'd been in the financial planning industry for a while. So my first day, I got switched over to a major bank, was August 1st, 2008. For anybody in the financial industry, that's a very famous time period when the markets are crashing, and all I get to say to everybody is, it's my first day, it wasn't my fault, I didn't do this. I was there for a year, and I left to go to a major insurance company for a couple of reasons. One, the financial planning to me at the bank was not financial planning so much as financial selling under the guise of advice. I wasn't wild about that, so I left to go into insurance, which offered more things that I didn't know you could do. After 2 years there, however, I left because I wanted to be more objective. I could still only offer one company's product or services, and I didn't feel you could be objective for the clients. And in 2011, I left to go independent, and then we'll fill you in how that went, because Mark... joined the industry around then as well, but Mark let him pick for himself. But then we joined forces over the years and started something fresh. So Mark, I'll pass it off to you, and then we'll talk about our company later on.
Okay. Yeah. So I was at UBC same time as Chris. Came out of commerce. Ironically, in a little bit of a similar situation in that I actually studied international business. And I planned to go to Asia. So I grew up in Asia, and I planned to go and at least live there for a number of years and get established there. That really got thrown off track by what was happening in Asia at the time. And there just realistically wasn't, for somebody starting out, it wasn't going to be a good option. I ended up working in a printing company. And I actually found out years later, my great-grandfather in Germany actually worked for years as he owned a printing company and started out as a typesetter. Typesetter being the guy who actually laid the lines of type to do the stamping in an old-fashioned type of press. So worked in that industry for a number of years. I was in a good mid-sized firm, consistent high producer. But it was something where I could see the future of putting ink on dead trees was not exactly bright. And I was either going to have to start something for myself, which would probably be outsourced, print brokering and being able to start something a bit entrepreneurial, or in knowing Chris's twin brother. He exposed me to the industry at really just the right time when I was looking for the right kind of thing. And he lined it up very well to say, you know, here's the kind of work we do. This is the type of people we serve. And this is the kind of good we do. And for me, being able to go into something where there's a real positive opportunity to do good work and help people at the end of the day was a big motivator, as well as being able to financially be stable, but also have a lot of flexibility in my life for that. Chris, myself, and his twin brother have known each other since grade 10 when I moved to Vancouver. So it's a long history.
I did know my brother a little earlier than that, but yeah. for all but 2 minutes of my life. So
yeah,
I always say best 2 minutes of my life. But yeah, so Mark, it's interesting that Mark and I, our friendship goes back longer than most of our clients have been alive. So it's always an interesting thing. Somewhat depressing, I guess. I don't know. But,
yeah, that's pretty cool that you were friends first. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think
I think a lot of people would shy away from building a business with friends. So I'd love to also pick your brain on, you know, why do you think that relationship works for you?
I would put it in one word. It's all about trust. We can trust that we've got each other's backs, that we'll do the work, that we can even have arguments and we'll still come back and not let it, you know, a disagreement in something, you know, phase us or throw us off track. It really needs to be about trust, because without it, it wouldn't matter who the person is anyway. So when you know somebody for over 30 years and you know you can trust them with your life, yeah, absolutely work as a partner. That's for me anyways. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we also, I would say that a big part of it is that Chris and I have, we have complementary skills. You know, Chris has certain, he has certain things he does well. I have certain things that I do well. And between the two, it actually fills out what we need from where we are today and really for what we're building going forward. Everything lines up pretty ideally. Like any situation, of course, nothing's ideal, but it's we fill in enough gaps that it makes us a very strong team. And it's pretty clear, I'd say, when something comes in, who's going to take what position, what role. I would also say we have the capacity to overlap with each other. So if there's a situation, Chris does most of our presentation. He loves presenting. I'm sort of agnostic on it. I can do it. I do it fine. Chris really gets excited about it and you can tell that in how he presents things. And so if there's a presentation, Chris will do it. If something happens, Chris, falls off a chair, gets delayed on a flight, he can't make it, I could pick up the notes and do a perfectly credible presentation. We also work with a small group of clients, so the two of us have enough time for us to be able to overlap a lot. So it's not like we have to divide and you do this work and I do that work and neither of us meet each other's clients. Most of our intake meetings, we would meet when we have a new referral, for example, we usually would both meet with them. If it's a 20-minute like online meeting, both of us would want to meet and just say, hey, you're going to be seeing both of us, depending on what we're doing and depending on where they came from. Certain people I probably align with better, certain people Chris will. And so we say, yeah, I'll be the primary point of contact, but Chris will know everything that's going on in any case. And we're pretty blessed in the clientele that we have, that we have that luxury. We have to do it because I think our clients would expect it, but also there's enough there that we're able to do it.
And it's kind of a built-in succession plan too, right? Like if something goes sideways, there's always, you know, you've got full continuity running, which is really cool. And just being able to work together, put two heads together on everything, I'm sure the outcome for clients is that much better.
Well, we also share very similar ethics, which is also extremely important. Is we would rather not have the business and do anything that would harm or not be good for the client's interest only. Mark and I have never wavered from that one. That's always been forefront of anything we recommend. It's as skilled advice as we can give that is only for the client's best interest. It's never ours. It's a lot easier to work together as a team when you both fully believe in that philosophy.
So both of you came from other industries, like you were not introduced to the financial services like super early on in your professional lives. And yet within a few years, and we'll chat more about what you guys do, but you've obviously specialized and you've built up a knowledge base that is fairly advanced. So what was that education journey like? Like, how did you learn what you now know?
I'll go. Mine was actually, I found it, when you do the financial planning, a lot of time you'll talk about insurance. And the issue for me that it always disturbed me was being trained to scare or shame your clients into buying. What would happen to your family if? And I just hated that. I didn't want anybody to feel stressed or strained about meeting with me. It should hopefully be a good experience for everybody. And so when I was at the insurance agency, like I said, one of the when I say major banks, major insurance agencies, these are the big players you would have heard of, but obviously I'm not there to badmouth any of them, but the issue was I didn't like how I was being trained. So when I did the certified financial planner, I was the first to go through the new system where they broke it up into instead of just one exam, it was all the courses, one exam. Then you actually had to write a financial plan. That was a new concept for a financial planner, having to write a financial plan. And then you qualified to write the second exam, the FBE2. And those would be 6 months apart. In between those two, I said, well, I've been studying hard. I want to also knock out the Chartered Life Underwriter because it was the first four courses the same and three more courses after that. I had just closed the exam on one, the advanced taxation program, when a client's accountant called me and for an hour and a half grilled me on all the tax concepts possible. And I'm flipping through the book. And at the end of the conversation, he says, okay, I can get behind this and support it. And it went from, in our days, like doing a $100 premium was a nice deal to this was an over $4,000 monthly premium. And it wasn't because a guy ever thought he'd be sick, and it was certainly not because he was not poor and needed the money. It was I was solving a tax problem. And I thought, this is interesting. I'm doing a larger case because I'm solving a tax problem for a client. That got me really onto the fascination of what else can you do to help mitigate a client's tax situations. And from there, I went on to the Registered Trust and Estates Practitioner because I find estate planning fascinating. It's where all the tax and legal really comes to a head, and I wanted to be an expert in that. So that, for me, was my route to it. I just thought I would rather work with the reality of you're going to be a successful person, we need to work on your tax problems, than what happens if somebody pushes you under a bus. And that was really my path.
Nice. And Mark?
So it would be a combination of having been having some background in finance. And then when I went into the industry, I did the usual thing of setting up, just individual family market planning. But I've always been a pretty fairly serious process guy. So I was, I bet if I went into my old backups, I would be able to find my first access program, my first CRM program. And I had my clients in a CRM program, and it just I didn't know how I would keep things organized without something like that. But I also wasn't at the point where I could be cutting checks to do Salesforce or do one of the big things. And I didn't know enough about the industry at that point, so it took a number of years to sort of get my feet under me. I'd say that I saw the benefits of the family market for the client, but I also saw that with the way that I work, it's as a revenue model, it's not viable. I think you can scale it with a team. You can probably scale it to the point that it is, but you have to do so many transactions, and just the way that I work is always, even the clients that I dealt with in previous companies, they were always the largest clients, and volume came from one strong connection or a few strong connections, rather than having to have this virtually retail sort of focus and being able to move from this client to the next client to the next client and leaving everybody else behind. So my focus always was on the professional markets. The choice to specialize came from, and I'd say one of the best things about coming into this industry was that Adrian sort of broke, Adrian is Chris's twin brother. He sort of broke ground with a lot of this stuff, and he found out, you know, all the things that don't work and the few things that do. And one of the big things was to worship at the feet, but certainly study at the feet of Bruce Etherington. We're big fans of him. I'd say we work differently, certainly different from, you know, his background in the family market when he was old school insurance, right? How you need to think about specializing and using some examples of how important that is. And as I did more in the industry, I could see that unless you already had scale or you're willing to scale up to a very large size into a more retail organization, you're going to have to specialize. And the choice ended up being just by virtue of the fact that we said, well, what's the one that everybody wants? And that was dentistry, right? Everybody says, oh, if I can.
So was it really that? Like, did you have any dentist clients at that point?
Not one.
So just one day, both of you got together and you were like, we're going to specialize and we're going to pick.
It actually came a bit more. Mark and I are both members of the Million Dollar Roundtable, which is the name is from a long time ago when writing $1 million of coverage was considered a massive amount. Now, of course, it's, you know, not so much. But from there, it's an organization with the top 1% in our industry from around the world. And what got us, it was sharing ideas. They would share ideas with us, and we would take those ideas and try some to implement and see how they'd work. And I was at one. It was a Bruce Etherington presentation in Toronto, and it was about specialization. And that's I really saw this. We were like, well, who are we going to specialize with? And at that time, everybody wants to work with physicians. But it's a well plowed field. Everybody wants to get a doctor, but we just tend to gravitate. Well, who we get along well with? And it was actually dentists because they run a similar business to ours. They would need to incorporate not just for tax purposes, but because they have a, you know, I guess I hate to say, but like a retail practice, people coming in to see them. They have partners. They have to have staff. They have to rent things. They have to buy equipment similar to what we do versus a physician who might incorporate in a hospital but doesn't actually have staff of their own, et cetera. So we could relate quite well with them. And then it was just simply about learning their profession, the business side of their profession. And we try to do as much as possible the actual side of profession, but I can't stand listening to drills, and so I'll only go so far in that field. But the idea was that as we came to understand their business, we could relate to them better and better and better. If you asked me about the construction industry, I wouldn't be able to answer very many questions about it. But if you ask us about dentistry, we can talk to you all day, all night about the dental practice, about partnerships, business valuations, etc., what they're going to face. And eventually, because they know that you know their business, they come to you. But further than that, we also want to specialize in working with younger people. Our business model is pretty much all centered around millennial dentists. And that came from years of being frustrated working with older physicians and dentists who, unfortunately, you can't reverse 10, 20, 30 years of no or bad planning. Not our bad planning, but you can only fix so much. Or they needed some insurance, but now they're unhealthy or whatever it could be. Like we couldn't fix it. So wouldn't it be better to work with them at the start of their career? And so we just kind of focused from there. And then now we would consider ourselves to be some of the top experts in working with young dentists as they graduate and start their careers. And we're the guys that come to for advice on how to do just that.
What was that journey like? Like how long did it take you to formulate? Like, did you just like say, this is the date when, you know, we are now only going to focus on dentists? Like, what was that?
It was a process. We spent, and I think we're still doing it, I'd say, Mark, like we're not done yet. But in 2014 is when I came home from MDRT thinking, okay, I've got to start doing this. How do I do that? And the first process was to figure out who did you want to work with? And the reality is, if you're going to specialize in people, you either have to do by volume or by I guess, revenue. I guess what I mean by volume is you either have to be, Mark talking about the family market and just have
the number of clients versus the
thousands
size
of clients.
Of,
yeah. I'm like, that sounds exhausting. I don't think you can spend a proper amount of time on each. So then you look by revenue. What's their income like? And then, okay, well, then you focus. And then it's really about asking them. So I would meet somebody. So, well, where do you guys like to hang out? What magazines do you guys like to read? Where do you guys get your financial information from? And it was just asking the questions and figuring out. And then we eventually would, now we have, you know, we have a marketing budget and we say, okay, if you give us X amount of dollars, we can find this many dentists. But that took, I guess, about 6 years, Mark, for us to be solidly in with the dental community. At first, you're the new kids on the block. They don't know who you are and why should they care? And so you really have to build a brand and a reputation that they trust, and trust takes time. So I guess that would be, around 2018, 2019 is when we really hit our stride for, we were bringing in dozens of new dentists per year. But it took a while to get there.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest, the first dentist I ever worked with, I came across them because I was doing a Christmas kettle, and the person who was supposed to come after me ended up not showing up. So I ended up staying longer, and somebody came to try to fill in. And it was, so we ended up basically overlapping. We had some time and they were asking what I do. It turns out they're a bookkeeper. And I said, you know, financial planning, our primary focus is dentists. I didn't have, this is when we were independent, I didn't have a dentist on the books, but that was the focus. So whenever somebody asked, I would say, yeah, primarily focused on dentists. We can work with other people, but that's generally where we spend our time, and that's what we focus on. And then this person, a couple of months later, put a client in contact with me, and they just said, oh, hey, I hear that you work with dentists. By this time we had already made some inroads informally into the dental side of things, but it was more from volunteering with some dental affiliated charities, doing things where we were positioning positively, and we could credibly say, I know Dr. such and such, or there's this. I mean, now it's sort of, it's an everyday, all day kind of thing. At that point, yeah, it was, you know, get your feet under you and be the most curious guy around of, you know, hey, if you would be comfortable, I do need your corporate documents to be able to fill in this corporately owned policy, but so I can make a case for the need for this insurance, could I get a copy of your financials for your clinic? I'd never seen clinic financials before. It was hours and hours and hours to try to go through it, comparing it to the kinds of financials that I'd seen previously. It's significantly different. Now those are the financials I know the best, but it took that time. And then eventually, as you start and ask every single person that same question, is it okay if I take a look at your financials? I'd be curious what's there. Collect information like a crazy person. You want to know everything about dentistry and about all the little touch points. It's easy to make mistakes, and people are pretty forgiving if they understand your intention. And it can be small things, knowing that how you would normally address people, whether you're in a clinic, whether you're in a, you know, doing the stuff in a charity, or, and I've always been pretty involved with charity stuff, and I do the charity for its own sake, but I'm also clear that I'm in this area, or I'm in that type of, in that focus. So where I would be doing something for cancer charities in any case, I'm in an oral cancer research and treatment focused team, because that's the area. These are the people that I know. And it's also a lot easier to get funding when you know a bunch of dentists and say, hey, we're raising money for oral cancer research. So just all your messaging and your marketing, as long as you stay consistent on that, you're not trying to figure out, you know, somebody has a somebody has a keychain that says they work for a construction company, like Chris says, and say, "Oh, we work on we focus on construction company owners or something like that." It's, you know, "Oh, hey, that's a construction keychain. Yeah, we mostly work with dentists." And even if the construction company guy is probably more likely to say, "Oh, wait a second. Oh, yeah, so dentists have lots of money. So, but what are they doing? What am I missing?" It really does, like, for me, it's important to have that, just to have that focus. I wouldn't want to have to be the guy who knows any credible amount about everything. It would be overwhelming.
I would say one key thing,
our area.
One tip I would give to other advisors, ask to see any legal documents you can. And that would be a contract offer. That would be a shareholders agreement, partnership agreements, even the bank agreements. You will learn so much about their business that way. We are not lawyers or accountants. We have the highest accreditation possible, but we still never say that we are lawyers or accountants. But we have seen so many of them that we can go through it confidently and say, "Look, you can have this reviewed by a lawyer. However, I know we're talking about restrictive covenants, or we're talking about their split, or we're talking about what happens upon termination." And not just about the products that you have to place, but about, we understand what we're looking at when you're asking us, "Okay, I've just been made an offer at a practice in Fort St. John. Can you guys review this? We'll take a look at it." And we know what we're doing and said, "It looks good to me. Always make sure it's reviewed." But we've also found a lots of business opportunities because I would have somebody saying, "I need a $2 million insurance policy for a loan from the bank." "Okay, well, can I see your partnership agreement?" "Well, the agreement also states that if the person passes away, that they need to have insurance." I said, "Well, actually, you need about $4 million because you're buying in for two. Two goes to the bank. You still owe two to the company on your death. And you're not the bad guy there. You're saying this is what you have already legally agreed to. I'm just the guy to tell you the best way to fund it." So it not only adds to your credibility that you can understand their contracts for working, and this would be across any industry where they'd have an independent contractor offer, whatever version that takes. But then they feel much more confident that you know their business side, and it's not just about the product. It's about, "I know you."
Yeah, I love that. And I want to expand a bit more. You both talked about it already, but I want to dig in a bit further on that. How do you break into a new target demographic? So, Chris, you were saying, like, you know, ask the questions, ask where they, you know, what magazines they read, and, you know, where they live, and how to find them. So can you elaborate further on that? Like, how does, like, if someone says, "Okay, this is the market I want to get into, an advisor," maybe they have one or two clients in that market, they're trying to break free from that retail.
No, it doesn't need to be, you know, I knew one dentist, he was my dentist, and I just asked him. People will generally know one person in an industry that they can ask a question from, even if they're just like, the first step would simply be, "Who do you think you'd like to work with? Is it real estate developers? Is it going to be, you know, medical person? Is it going to be lawyers or accountants?" Most people will know at least one person somewhere. And you're not asking for the business. You're just asking them what magazines you like to read. "Tell me about, you mind asking me if I can ask a few questions about your business?" Just to get, I mean, what's the number one thing people like to talk about? It's themselves. And you're just asking them to tell you about them. So when you do that one, think about who you'd like to work with. Start asking questions. Read the magazines or read the articles or the whatever it comes through, and start to understand and start to learn the lingo. I mean, I don't know how many times Mark and I have said the word loops to our dentists, but they go crazy every time they hear the word loops. It's because we're talking something that they understand, and they're, you know, and it's just these little casual bits that you put in there just gain you a little bit more trust at a time. And then from there, the next step I'd say is, once you have articles, you may do some articles in a magazine that they read. That's one way. You know, it will take some time, but you might get some business out of there, and then you can grow the business from there. But it's really, we also asked, like, Mark was really good at this, about getting us into study groups, dental study groups, and doing presentations for there. And that's where we meet them. We offer free presentations, really great food. But the whole point is that you may only come away with one person, but that one person was worth 20 of your previous markets going from there. And then if you really wow them and amaze them, they will. We just had was it just yesterday? We had another dental specialist just email us out of the blue saying, hey, another specialist colleague of mine needs help with this one. Can you help them out? And it just came, and those are not uncommon emails for us anymore. It was, you know, we would be running around banging on the pots when that would happen, you know, a number of years ago. And now, just because of the nature of it, we're like, hey, so-and-so, and we sent, actually, Mark, do you want to tell them about the, when we had that other dentist referred that other dentist, and we did that little gift or the donation. It's a really great tip. Yeah.
It's, you know, to drive behavior. You know, I'll be honest that 99% of our clients, I guess, either come from, you know, we've met them at events where we've been presenting, or by referral. And one thank you I like, and this was last week. I had it was about two, three weeks ago, when I first met this person. And she booked a meeting. She reached out by email and met with her introduction meeting. And I said, how did you find out about us? And she said, oh, well, this person, and I can't go into the details, but this person had worked with me in sort of as a trainee kind of thing. And we became friends a couple of years ago, and has some stuff that's been proposed to them. And she's just really good. I was really confused. And she said, well, you should talk to Mark. He's great. Blah, blah, blah. And the thing that Chris is referring to, and it's one of my favorite referrals to, like, referral thank yous. If you know your client, you know the kind of person they are, the kind of heart they have, is to go to Seva, seva.ca. So that's an eyesight restoration charity. And they do very cost-effective eyesight restorations. And for $50 or $75, you can have somebody's eyesight restored. And so I'll write a note in there saying, you know, thank you. And because you thought to have somebody see me, somebody can see. And it says, you know, we did this in Tanzania or in Nepal or what have you. And it's just a heartwarming little thing. Choose it with you can do it via email, but you can also, they have a very nice package that comes to the person that was being thanked for it. And it's such an easy donation for us to make. $75. I mean, you could buy an okay bottle of scotch, I guess, and drop it off. But between those two, to just have that feedback of, hey, I put this person in touch with Mark, and it turns out the person I was meeting with, and this is bizarre, but had actually had a scare with their eyesight within the last 6 months. And something had happened where it could have, I think it was a sports accident or something. And it was, she said, oh yeah, I was actually really worried about my eyesight. That's such a thoughtful gift. And it's such a thoughtful thank you. The other thing that I wanted to add on with what Chris was saying, and this, if you're going into a market, in our case, dentistry, I'd say this is the case with any of them. Get your finances and your funds in order, because it is to be fully invested, you have to be able to meet that dentist when you don't have anything on the books, meet that next person, dentist, whatever your focus is, and not assess them for insurance needs. You have to be the guy that says, hey, you know, we work in this area. You know, if you ever have questions about cash flow planning or what have you, I'd be happy to sit down and go through stuff. I've got some questions. I want to see how your company, how your clinic works. But, you know, I look for the places where you can add value, and do not try to look for a transaction, because every other guy that's been in front of them from our industry has done exactly that. Oh, you're making this. Oh, there's a big mistake in how your insurance is set up. There almost always is. It's, you know, I know it's there, but I'd rather get them through three or four steps, or even if it's a year or two. And when Chris says, you know, we'd like to get them young, and the downside of getting them young is cash flow. We don't do permanent insurance on people who don't have corporations. They won't need a corporation most likely. I mean, they might be first year out. They might incorporate if they're in some small town and working like crazy. But the majority of them, 2 to 3 years out from dental school, then we would start looking at some level of permanent insurance, where everybody is assessing them and saying, how much permanent insurance can this person buy? Well, they just got out of school with $350,000 of line of credit, another $60,000 to $70,000 of Canada student loans, and they want to build up money for a down payment and get into the real estate market because everybody else has. There's no space in there, and there's no call in there for permanent insurance. And permanent
It's not appropriate at that stage in there.
Absolutely. But it means that, you know, after you've spent the kind of money doing the sponsorships and the events and all this stuff, you say, I'm going to secure somebody that, I mean, on the long end, it's about 7 years before we'll see the real dollars come in. But we're also the guys along the way that will say, oh, that person said you really are missing out by not putting money into permanent insurance. Still have $280,000 of student loans and you want to buy a house next year. That's not going to happen with this. And never use personal dollars for it. It doesn't make sense for a professional, in very, very rare circumstances. So, you know, it is that long. I mean, thank God we're far enough into the life cycle of our company and the buildup. Now we just need to keep replacing the new 7 years out, and we're capitalizing on the people that have come before them, and is creating a structure that allows everything else to be funded. So we're getting the payoff, but it was a lot of very, very lean years to get to the point of, and I'd say growing to the point where we were actually differentiated and we were providing a service to our clients. I wouldn't feel uncomfortable if my client took an offer from some financial advisor to have lunch. They're probably funnier than me. They might be almost surely better looking. But at the end of the day, I know the kinds of the work that we do for our clients. The other guy, he doesn't want to have to do that much work. And we created a structure that helps, thankfully, allows us to be able to do this. I'd say at scale. I mean, it's not at massive scale, but at the scale of the clients that we serve. Absolutely. They have updated financial plans. They have their check-ins. They have their, once we have their investments, there's reporting. There's lots of touch points, lots of check-ins, and everything is on a structure and in a system. And it's very targeted toward that clientele. And you could do that. I mean, you could replicate our system for any other group of people. You just need people that specialize in that particular area. I think there's a huge opportunity in high tech. You get the right kind of people in and align them with understanding what we do and that these people understand systems and saying, here's, we'll allocate this to do what you want, but we're going to also, you know, somebody's got to plant cabbages some days, right? And let's do some of that boring stuff and plant potatoes and cabbages. But that's part of the overall and say, here, we're going to there's a lot of overlap. It's just where we have worked with maybe some people that have been referred to us in tech. It's so on and off, and it gets to be so scaled up. Dentistry is nice in that it's a professional service that's always needed.
I would give one more tip as well. It would be to, we offer to do financial plans on spec to our accountant. We took about another 6 years developing an accountant who's now a solid referral source for us. But we were challenged, like, we would like to show you what we can do. And it was simply give us, with your client's permission, but the names will be client A and client B for a couple. And just so it's with all identifying features stripped out, what we'd recommend, written reports back, presented to your clients. If they'd like to meet with us, we'd be delighted to do so. But their anonymity is completely preserved. You can not only show the clients what you can do, but actually our key goal is actually show the accountant what we can do. It was a bonus if we could write the stuff, the business on the clients, but the accountant got to learn to not only know that we know our stuff, but would trust us and trust the reports, and now is our number one referral source for older dentists and older medical professionals who need help at a point where the accountant says, I'm at the limit of what any accountant can do. I'm sending these guys to you because they can help you with other things that, you know, require, you know, you can use insurance for, et cetera. Again, that took years, but offer to do things on spec without their names, and you'll be surprised at the results. Like, you have to be able to back up your words, but if you can do it, you'll earn their trust.
That's pretty amazing. So did you just figure out who the accountants were when you first started acquiring clients? Like, who are the accountants that specialize in dentistry?
No, actually came from public speaking, believe it or not. I did the president, actually just now I just moved to past president, yay, of the Fraser Valley Estate Planning Council. It's the lawyers, accountants, financial planners. Her Mark stood up when he was a first-time member and said, Chris would. Chris told me to be accountants, lawyers, financial planners, and have lots of fun. Like, so I think that's fun for us, I guess. Maybe not everybody's cup of tea for an evening dinner booth. But the idea is, I did a presentation there, and a lawyer came up to me and introduced himself to me. He said, I want to be working with you, because I was saying how I specialize in work dentists. He then introduced me to the accountant that he just started working with, and we went from there. And it was really just about putting yourself out there, about saying, here's the information. Like, all of our presentations are information that we encourage. Like, you can take this back to your own financial advisor, to your own accountant, ask them about this that you've seen with us. We are so confident in our work that we know there's not going to be any room for them to shoot anything down. But it just lends an area of authority and of credibility to say, when we do so many public speaking events or financial planning events and whatnot, if you can't explain it to a lay person visually, then you really don't know what it is you're trying to talk about. And accountants, their number one worry is they will never want to be, and who would, to be embarrassed in front of the clients, either by not knowing something or deducing what they thought were financial planners who just turned out to be insurance hacks going in there and trying to sell. So, and that's why it takes years to earn their trust. But once you do, you're their go-to guys. But yeah, also asking around again.
That can also be taken from the other side, and I think it's probably an opportunity that a lot of people maybe miss. Is, if you are, like, when you say, what if you have one or two clients in your ideal target area, and you say, I really want to focus on those clients. When you make your recommendations, and we do this with all our recommendations, but what Chris is saying about saying, you know, I'd like this to be put in front of your accountant. I'd like to get their blessing before you move forward on this. And I will put together the information. And if they have any questions, they can ask me about it. Well, if you're trying to find clients, a group of clients that work in the same area, they probably use the same accountant. And being that person, or if you're doing, if you're getting insurance for security for a loan, yeah, put yourself in front of the lawyers and say, here's the information, here's all, you know, here's the beneficiaries, confirm all the stuff that they want to have confirmed. Overdo it to some extent. And honestly, if you want to have a differentiator to get to those accountants, do an annual report of insurance and just say, here's the insurance this client has, these are the beneficiaries, these are the blah, blah, blah. If you have any questions, please let me know. Nobody does that. And it's not rocket science. It's a little bit of work. But if you know that accountant deals with a lot of physiotherapists and you want to work with physiotherapists, he's going to say, oh, this company, Grow Your Wealth. Wow, those guys, they send me this statement every year. And it's, you know, nobody else does that. That's fantastic. They're great. A great introduction to that.
One quick thing, another tip that, like I said, the Fraser Valley Estate Planning Council, those councils are all over Canada. There's a Vancouver Estate Planning Council, Abbotsford, Toronto, you name it. There are informal, like or dinner organizations where you will be accountants, lawyers, financial planners, charitable gift officers, and they get together every couple of months. We get together for dinner and a presentation on something to do with estate planning. I first joined mine, and it is 2010. And then I joined the executive board in 2014, and now I've been 8 years on the executive board, and I've gotten to know many lawyers and accountants, and you kind of, at that point, you almost get to pick and choose who you'd like to work with at that point. So that would be my advice, is to search out those organizations, join them. It won't be an overnight thing, but as you're having dinner every, you know, a couple months, you'll be chatting up with lawyers and accountants, and it's a great way to meet people.
I love it. I love how many nuggets came out of that last, like, well, the whole time, but especially in the last like 10 minutes. So anyone listening should really like go back 10 minutes and listen again. We're also going to have a transcription available on the site for the podcast. Marketing consistency. So I heard lots of, you know, you mentioned that you need to be consistent. So I think Mark, you said this, and you've provided tons of examples of how you are being consistent on the messaging, the approach, and really taking a multi-pronged approach to getting to know the client, getting to know all the other advisors that client demographic normally works with. Very cool. Very, very cool. Are these all things, like, how did you learn them? Like is it for example, from the MDRT, things like that, just things you've learned, thought of, implemented, added to your system over time?
I mean, I think it's a lot of it is just looking at it's just paying attention, seeing what the client, where is the client going to be? What are they going to see? And it's the same with how we build our processes. It really comes from putting yourself in the client's shoes and say, what would an ideal client experience be? What would I want to experience as a, let's say in our case, a 2017 graduate from UBC dentist? Well, I'd want to meet somebody who knows a lot about my industry. I'd want to know a little bit about practice valuations and why are they so crazy right now, and know some key players in the industry, and understands how our cash flow works and doesn't fall off their chair when I still have $180,000 of student loans after 5 years. Seeing it from that perspective, if you can put yourself in the client side and say, what will they experience, not just when they walk through the door, but as we work together? Our process is slow. It has lots of steps and it takes a long time to get sort of paid. But it also means that, you know, we do have steps along the way where there is revenue that helps to fill in, whether that's some wealth or term insurance or those sorts of things. But really thinking about where they are going to congregate, where they spend their time, and what stuff they like doing. If you're looking to be with medical professionals, you're a whole lot more likely to find them on a road bike than on a downhill mountain bike, right? Downhill mountain biking is super fun. But for people whose entire job operates, you know, just with what their hands can do, very fine motor work. Some do, but not a lot of them will be doing downhill mountain biking. A lot of them will be doing road biking, though, and I meet lots on the road. So yeah, get your butt on a bike and get used to that horrible saddle. I think that can be, you just need to figure that out for whatever sector. But then also, like, just having a service mindset. Especially where you're trying to attract the clients that everybody wants. I grew up in the hotel business. So I grew up in Asia. We were in the hotel business and we were in high-end hotels and my dad was a GM. So he wasn't the guy who owned the hotel, but he was the manager. He was in charge. There's understanding, like, from the guest's perspective, you know, if they're spending whatever was the equivalent at the time in the 1970s, I'm horrified to admit, whatever the equivalent is of $500-$600 a night, saying, well, what do you expect when you walk through the door? How do you expect to be greeted? What do you expect to smell? What do you expect to hear? What things do you not expect to have to encounter? So what's that going to be for a particular client? And I think it extends to how we run our business. So, we've spent a lot of time sourcing, whether it's really nice pad folios and the materials that go in, and our clients don't want to go to a website to update their address. So there's, you know, we have some stuff with QR codes and it's just click and they're just update my address or whatever. It's just that, I think when you have a, and I mean, it's it's been overdone, but that's, you know, once you have your why figured out, everything else just aligns to say, this is what my brand should feel like. This is what my clients should think about me and feel about my brand. No client has ever gone out and bragged to their friends about how big a check their insurance advisor got them to cut. They're bragging to their friends saying, oh, he warned me about that. Or he said, and I'll let you know, our biggest, I would say this is our biggest secret of all, the most powerful sales tool you can have in our experience is to say to a client, is to build out, you show them some juicy permanent insurance and it's a big, whatever, $50,000-$100,000 a year of funding and it's going to do this and you're going to have this much in retirement, blah, 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 blah. And the most powerful thing you can say to them is, but you're not ready yet. We will work. You'll get there. I guarantee you'll get there, but you're not ready yet. Over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, once we see enough in retained earnings and we start allocating, or we're going to protect the ability to buy that in the future. So we need this. We're going to be with that insurer. So we're going to buy this much term and we're going to have that in place. And next year we'll talk about it at your annual meeting, but you won't have enough in retained earnings by that point. Well, our clients constantly come back and beat our planned expectations. We tend to be conservative in our numbers. And so they come back and say, well, you know, we were going to do that in 5 years. Well, you're down to about 3 years. And then next year you say, oh, okay, well, you're past where you're supposed to be in 5 years. So let's do the conversion. We don't even have to apply anymore. We're just doing the paperwork to have a conversion. And now it's for the client. They've been planning for this for a few years. It's not a terrifying process, and they're happy to cut the check. They know where the money's coming from, and you've seen enough consistency. You also don't have to worry about a chargeback or 3 years later, the client just saying, I still can't figure out what he was talking about. And I don't know if I don't want to cut that next annual check. And you're trying to convince them to do it, to save face in the industry. It gets rid of all that, but yeah, it means you get paid in year 4 or 5, not in year 1, right?
And do you collect any planning fees along the way, or you kind of take them on? What's your onboarding experience like? Like, how much time do you spend with clients in the early days?
I'd say so. Our first meeting, first intro meeting, I'm assuming some of these most commonly would be a referral. So we'd have a 20-minute online meeting that I'll leave the full hour blocked. So they book it through Calendly, but I'll block the hour just in case we get off on a tangent. And I'll let them know. I'll say, look, I'm fine with 20 minutes. If you've got to get back to your clinic or if you have something planned, it's perfectly fine. But I have the whole hour booked because sometimes we end up, and sometimes I've had discussions with clients where it gets pretty in-depth and they have a million questions right off the hop because they don't often meet people that have the insight that Chris or I would have in our little narrow area. So then from that, we would, you know, why did you want to meet with us? Is there a problem that needs to be solved? Is there something that you want to deal with first? And we can get that out of the way. That could be something as simple as agent record change with a disability and then applying for to remove an exclusion. Or it could be, you know, I've had stuff present to me. I don't know if this is the right thing to buy and all sorts of crazy ideas. And you say, well, okay, then that, before I can do anything, you need a financial plan, but I don't know what to say to you until I have a full analysis. So I need to collect all the information. I do that by building a financial plan. I relate it with a dentist to saying, well, you know, you can look at my smile and say, oh, he might have a cavity here, or he might need a crown, or maybe he has a crown that's prepped wrong and is about to fall off. But you won't know that until you look at the x-rays and look in my mouth. I need to look in your mouth and I need to get some x-rays. And the x-rays might be asking for your financial statements or talking to your accountant or what have you. So I would say the planning meeting and data gathering, minimum 2 hours, 1 hour client-facing time with a second hour blocked. And I, again, say I have the second hour blocked. I collect the information that I need. We do some projections out. We do very pretty tight cash flow planning for this year, next year, because we know what happened this year, we say, is it going to be, it's going to be up, it's going to be down, is it going to be 10% more, is it going to be 2% more? And so going forward, then we say, well, as we go further, I tend to plan it in based on, well, what do you think is an appropriate income for you in the position you plan to be in? What does this look like? Okay, let's build that out. So now we have our short term and our long term. Factor a couple of hours for that, depending on what the needs are. Very often they're coming to us with a question, so we'll look at solving that question. But we're simply saying, yep, the next, if you don't have any questions, you don't have anything that needs to be solved, or let's say you can't figure out a Great West Life exclusion. I can't take over a Great West Life policy, but I can tell you what information you should be putting down, and I'll work with you to put the information down. And whoever you're dealing with, ask them to submit the following. And then usually it works. And I say, well, the next time I'm going to meet you is going to be January or February, because that's when we do our annual plan updates. And one of the questions, Chris and I will very often be in the same meeting. And when we go in that 20-minute meeting, and I say, this is what our plan, I walk them through the financial planning and the software, and this, you know, say, this is the stuff you'll see. These are the screens you're going to interact with. All my clients know these screens. And then the client will invariably ask. If they don't ask, I'll mention it, but he'll go like this. And he'll be like, they're waiting to find out how much this costs. Because everybody says this must have a cost attached to it. Well, the reality is we work with a very narrow group of clients, and we're here to serve those clients. And I say, look, if I'm dealing with the right client, whether I get paid this year, I get paid next year, I know in the long term, you're the type of client that's going to have very significant needs. If I do my job right, you're only going to want to do that work with me. We're going to have a gentleman's agreement that I say, if I bring you a recommendation, this is straight playbook from Bruce Etherington, is I'm assuming that if I bring you a recommendation and I've done the backup work and I've proven a need and I've discussed, you know, I've laid everything out for you, I would assume you would work with me instead of choosing to work with somebody else. If we're in a situation where I will never get paid and we'll never be able to work together for whatever reason, if you're my ideal client type and you don't know that, I'm fine to work with you. If you come in and say, my uncle is an insurance advisor, I have to buy everything from him, and my wife is an investment person, I will never put a penny in your pocket. I normally, with those people, I'd say, look, if you have some current issues, I wouldn't want to work with them in the long term. But I say, look, we've already had a bit of discovery. I've already learned a bit about you. I'll give you an idea of what my planning should cost per hour. I'll let you know how many hours I put into it. And gentleman's agreement, you make a donation to whether it's my Ride to Conquer Cancer or Tour to Cure Now, or to Stella's Voice, which is an orphanage in Eastern Europe, or SEVA, or a charity of your choice. But I mean, my preference would be a charity where I can see it. And we just have gentleman's agreement to say, yeah, if what you feel it's worth, you make that donation. It also means I don't have to deal with collecting GST and charging for the service. And, you know, they'll still have an engagement agreement before we're going to get their information. So I have to put it in my software. But we're going to have an explicit one that says, I'm only doing this, and I'm just doing this as a service where we don't have a contract around this. So it's just more for disclosure and stuff. Because we won't do business together. That doesn't happen very often, though.
I would also suggest that specializing really helps. This week, I had 7 dentist meetings. Believe it or not, that's a very full week. And I meet other advisors who want to meet 10 a day, 10 anybody a day. Because we work with fewer clients, we have the ability to spend 1 or even 2 hours with them. It might be 20 minutes, might be 2 hours. It just depends. Our clients love it that we remain focused on them. They are our focus. That meeting, I might have just 1 meeting a day, but we are focused on that meeting. They're high value clients. We'll generate high revenue from them. I don't need to have 10, 20 clients a day. I don't need to rush people through a 15-minute session. It is, we're going to take as much time. I blocked off 2 hours. We should only be half an hour, but just in case. And you will be amazed at how much the clients appreciate that you're not just going to rush them in and out, that you're here for them.
That's really awesome. We're getting close to the end of our time. So I would like to ask you a couple of sort of closing questions. And really, you know, if you could change one thing about our industry as a whole, what would it be?
Chris and I have the same answer for this. Chris can say, because we both have the same answer.
Yeah, we've talked about this well before this. And what drives us crazy is the really low barrier to entry into our industry. I am always curious. We go to restaurants. There's always some bulletin board that people put up, you know, business cards on. And I'm always curious who's on there. There's people who are a month into the industry, because you can look up when they got licensed, and they're holding themselves out as tax planning experts. Mark, I'm 14 years in the industry. Mark's 10 years in the industry. 12 years ago, I would never say I'm a tax expert. I mean, so that's one thing. But also that for permanent insurance, for example, we think in order to sell permanent, you should at the minimum have a certified financial planner designation. You need to understand the tax side of things. I even put forth to the insurance council president and the chief auditor. I mean, if there's two people you don't want to get into a room on, it might be those people if you're not confident in what you're doing. But I said, look, what I would like to see is every time there's any permanent insurance illustration or application done, there's a sign off by the client that you have gone through all their risk needs first. Because unfortunately, people go after the high commission stuff first. I say, no, we've seen people who have, you know, really high premiums, and yet if they were to become unable to work, couldn't even afford their insurance premiums, let alone just food over on the table and a roof over their head. So those are my big things. I would like to see a higher barrier of entry with more rigorous, financial planning and financial advisor title protection is coming in. It's in Ontario. It's a little watered down than what I would like, but it's a place to start. But I would like to see much more accreditation and annual accreditation, and not just a checklist of I've got 30 CE credits a year. Mark's in favor of having all of us write the CFP exam every couple of years. I don't know if I'd go that far.
No, Chris, for you it would be easy, right? Like you were the top for your year on the CFP exam.
That was a surprise. I have to say, I had just left the insurance company to go independent, and I remember sitting in my car outside the house. I get a phone call from FP Canada. Formerly it was the FPSC, and they called. I thought they were just calling to let me know for some reason that I could now use. I knew I had passed. I had no idea that I had done in first place, none whatsoever. But I actually had to. When you can leave an exam thinking, "Hey, that was a fun afternoon. I enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun." Like, then you know you've done well. But they said, "No, we're here to book your trip out to Ottawa for the award. Like, what are you talking about? You got first place." What? I had no idea. So like I said, Mark is really all over that. Every couple of years, I like to make sure everybody who's a CFP stays a CFP and earns the right to that one here. I would just like to see more of that. But Mark even more so than me, I think. Mark really is passionate about making sure that those who hold themselves out as being accredited, as being financial planners, really are and are up to date and can actually present ethical and proper plans to the clients. We both are, but Mark, that's your particular thing, Mark, I'd say.
I would say compensation drives behavior so much in our industry. And the reality is that the compensation is so front-end loaded that there's no service. You stick around for the first 2 years after a big case. And after that, it's laughable. I still have trails. We both still have trails from the old family market. And I mean, I have trails that are a few cents on a particular line of a policy. When I first started in family market, I would ladder with, back in the day with Transamerica, now in Ivari, you could ladder, so they would save the policy fee. And I would ladder out for life needs. So I would just say, okay, this, you know, kids are 10 years old, then they're, you know, then it drops down. We would do the matching with CI, and you could roll all of that for two people. So I usually have six policies in one policy fee. And my favorite thing would be if somebody said, but, you know, I'm going to ask around, and I know a guy from Sun Life. I'm going to see what he can do. Well, I know the Sun Life would have to do a policy fee for everyone. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to blow him out of the water. Oh, absolutely. Do your due diligence. Ask everybody about it. But yeah, the trails on those.
We used to have a private.
Whoever has the smallest trail from a particular company in a week has to buy coffee that day.
I love it. I'm totally on board for more professionalization and like a higher bar. Like, I wrote the insurance exam like in a week, and the CSC in a week. It was such a joke to get in. And on day one, I knew like literally nothing, but I could sell whatever I wanted. And it's scary. It was scary to me that I had the power to do that. And like, I really didn't know anything.
But I would say to everybody as well, don't be afraid to try things. If I give one tip, I mean, I didn't know anything about taxes. I want to learn it. So I went after, don't go after the weekend designations, go after the ones that are going to be hard. Even if you don't fail it or don't pass the first time you fail it, the CFP does have a high failure rate, but go after it, learn it. The more you do, the more you, the better you'll be. Don't be afraid. Mark has brilliant ideas on marketing. We try them. Most work, some don't, but whatever we do, we improve upon those ones. Do it, just jump in. I call it the icy water treatment. I if it's someone that's going to jump in and going to hyperventilate, then just do it. That would be my biggest tip. Go after the proper designations, go after the marketing, go after the clients, ask them what do you like to read, where do you guys get together, things of that nature. That would be my biggest takeaway for people. Just do it.
Love it. Be fearless.
Really quick one that actually everybody should do, and this is something that Chris did and has done extremely well with it, is so when you have that target clientele, build an ideal presentation. Even if you don't have anybody to talk to about it, practice it, get it ready, and let anybody know in any group, any association. We've used this trick a lot of times, where we say to any group that we want to get into, but they say we're booked up for the next 2 years, we say, I've got a presentation that's ideal for your marketplace. It's ready to go. You call me with 2 hours heads up. I can show up and do that presentation. We have some that are generic that we can do to anybody that always land well, but that's based on experience. If you build that presentation and say, hey, I can do something that's going to be entertaining. I'm going to, and look for places to talk, but, and practice that in person. But if you have that ready, if there's a group you can't get into, just say, yeah, don't book me, but keep me in mind, because if your guy drops out at the last second, lots of people plan to do public speaking and then they're terrified at the last minute. Be the guy who's ready to jump in and say, just keep my number around. Let me know. Last minute, I'll be there. I want to talk to you guys.
I love it. Last question. Where to from here? Where are you guys headed long term?
We've talked about that too.
Yeah. It's further refining. It's further process. I mean, we've got a, I'm completely in love with our SOP. I use old, sort of old school, but sort of Asian terminology, but policies and procedures. We have a fantastic policies and procedures, and we have a structure with, we have a custom built CRM. We have a lot of touch points. All our touch points are really well built out. Now the time is to scale that into, we could do other markets. Realistically, we're better off in scaling to a second location, having the same focus, and then developing a select group of people to run an office that uses the horsepower of what we already have in the back end, because everything's built. You just need to transfer the knowledge and to be able to do the secret sauce of what we have on the planning side. And the presentations are already built. The planning's already built. Now we just have to have somebody who's clever enough to be able to understand it and translate that to our professional clientele or to the new professional clientele. And then it's just rinse, copy, and repeat.
Yeah. And also, I've been talking about this with Mark for a while. I'd like to find Mark or me, but half our age. We'd like to, because each year we get further and further away from our client, our target demographic of millennial dentists, right? We'd love to find one solid protege that we could train well to take over the onboarding of the new dentist. We'd still be presenting, etc. Then freeing like Mark to be working with our existing, we have a large base of dentists right now, and myself is I would like to move into the estate planning more. So, but we would need to have trusted people. We've spent so many years and so much blood, sweat, and tears, pretty literally, building up our reputation and branding with the dental community, we're obviously not going to let that go, but we need to have somebody that we can trust, who wants to grow, who's excited to grow in the industry, who's hungry, not starving. They want to, you know, they want to do all the work we do. We'll guide them, we'll mentor them. And then eventually when we trust that they will represent our brand well, to take over that side of the young dentists, work within established dentists, and eventually with the estate planning as well. So I think that's our next one. It's down the path. We're not there yet, but we are actively looking around for that, I think.
That's awesome. Well, thank you both so much for joining the show. There was so much value in all the insights that you shared. It was amazing.
That was a lot of fun, Sam. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for having us, Sam. That was fun.
Last tip, I think, Mark, end of the week, Mark and I have a staff meeting, which means beers and nachos at a local pub. So I think that's, we do a weekly roundup like that. Never hurts.
Well, it is Friday today, and sounds like that might be up next for you guys.
Wonderful. Next up, patio. Yep. Sounds good.
All right. Take care. Have a great weekend.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us on yet another episode of the Grow Their Wealth Financial Advisor Podcast. Stay tuned for our next episode and write me at sham@growyourwealth.ca. That's sham@growyourwealth.ca with feedback, questions, and even suggestions for guests I should invite to the show. See you next time.